Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's the second part of the program here on May 7th, 2013. And I want to remind you, send me an email at info@realmeals.org. We can continue today's conversation or any other conversation you'd like to start, especially if it's about food. Love to hear from you, and I like to know what you're thinking. Okay, now let's move on to the next part of the program. My next guest is David Bedrick. He is a counselor, attorney, teacher, and author. He spent 8 years teaching psychology and philosophy on the faculty of the University of Phoenix and taught it in the Navy, at 3M, the American Society of Training and Development, the Process Work Institute, psychological associations, and small groups focusing on personal growth. He received notable awards for teaching, employee development, and legal services to the community. And he's the author of a new book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. Welcome to It's All About Food, David.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure being here. It's a beautiful day here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. 7,000 feet in the mountains and enjoying the beauty today.
Okay, I was wondering where you were, because I thought if I had a problem, I would want to see you.
Oh, thank you. And I would tell you that you have no problems, and you would say, why am I with you then?
I like to think I have no problems, but we all have issues, one small and large, and that's life.
Yes,
sometimes.
Absolutely.
I think that if we didn't have issues, we wouldn't be here.
Mm. Amen.
But I like your approach. This is a love-based process that you have. And that's very important, because I think that's when it all comes down to it, that's why we're here, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't get that.
Yeah. I wrote the book and talking back to Dr. Phil, Alternative to Mainstream Psychology, and I focused on Dr. Phil not because he's the person to go after, but he's a straw man. He represents the way of thinking that many of us think inside. He says to his guests on his show, well, how's that working for you? Or what are you thinking? As if people are doing the strange or disturbing things they're doing because they're screwed up somehow. And we can agree or disagree with that, but that attitude very rarely helps,
mm-hmm.
and it leaves people feeling more ashamed of themselves. And then when it doesn't work, when I say, well, is eating that ice cream working for you? And you say, well, no, it's gaining me weight. Then I say, well, then stop it. Well, you don't need a psychologist to tell you that, right? We tell ourselves those kinds of things all day long, feel worse and worse about ourselves, but the improvement doesn't happen.
Well, let's look at history for a moment. I want to think that we're evolving, that we're getting better, mm-hmm. although there are plenty of things that are going on in the world today, and I really wonder. But when it comes to psychiatry and psychology, these things have moved. We were decades or hundreds of years ago, people were analyzed one way or another, and I think we've come a long way. But there's a long way that we need to go. And I think your approach is definitely in the right direction. Now, I don't watch television very much, but I have caught Dr. Phil from time to time. And I've never liked the show. It always makes me feel kind of creepy.
Right.
And I feel the same way when I watch many Dr. Oz segments or The Doctors. And you made some analogies about how we treat emotional and mental issues and the way we treat physiological issues, health issues. We tend to focus on one thing. We're a terribly reductionist society. We don't think of the whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And your idea of the whole incorporates a number of different things, and definitely important, like the family or other people, your community, and we're all participants in everyone's issues.
Mm-hmm. That's so important, actually. Thanks for bringing that up. Not many people actually raise that issue with me, because I wrote quite a bit about family and community and part of psychology. For instance, psychology, I think, took a good leap when when family systems ideas came out. And family systems therapy said, if you and I are partners, Karen, and we have little Johnny as our son, right? And mm-hmm. little Johnny is doing things that don't look so good, where he's breaking something or he's spitting at a bus driver, I'm thinking of different clients, right? Or something like that. We think, let's send little Johnny to therapy. Well, that might be helpful, let's say. But family system said, Johnny is part of our system. That means he might be expressing something that we, you and I, aren't. Maybe you're not spitting it out and saying something to me, or maybe I'm not, you know, saying, that's it, let's break this idea, let's break this notion between us, so to speak. And if you and I aren't doing that, then little Johnny might. So family systems called the client, the child, the identified patient, but actually the family is. So mm-hmm. in that case, what most people don't realize is we're all part of a biological family, parents and siblings, but we're also part of a community. So many people look at themselves and say, what's wrong with me? But many of the things people struggle with are not only theirs. That's such a radical idea for people to internalize, but it's so true. There's internalized issues. Internalized sexism, for instance, is a very big part of women's struggles around body weight and dieting. We could talk more about that. But many women look in the mirror and they see, they look at themselves not looking the way they want to look. They don't think that their diet dilemma and struggle is part of a cultural problem, and it surely is.
It is, and I love the way, as I mentioned before, these analogies are really the same, where we need to treat the body as a whole, and we need to, if we want to repair a community, we need to treat it as a whole, and when we need to deal with these issues you're talking about, it's not just the individual, it's their surroundings and the people involved. And I'm jumping around, but
please do, yeah.
Denial. Of course parents don't want to think that they're to blame, mm-hmm. and they want to send their child to an expert.
Right.
But
right.
Of course they're participants in the problem, and I don't know why it's not obvious, but I guess it's hurtful to acknowledge that we contribute to a problem.
Yeah. It takes a certain level of, call it maturity, call it eldership, to take a hit, take the responsibility without beating oneself up. So if I don't have enough love inside of me or around me and the people who are around me, and you say, David, sometimes you talk too much. That's true about me, by the way. I do. I've talked for years. I've gotten that feedback many times. So it's true. But if I don't feel good about myself enough, even when I hear that truth, I won't be able to say, you're right, Karen, let me back off and make more space, because I'll end up being so self-hurtful afterwards that I can't afford that, as it were. So it's not because you're not telling me the truth, it's because psychologically I can't afford the hit. It's too big a tax for my psyche, and I'm going to have to go to sleep and feel ashamed of myself. That's not such a good result, right? So
right.
It takes a certain level of development to say, what is my role here, without walking away thinking, oh, I'm a terrible person, or I'm a terrible parent, et cetera. That cost is too much. Then the person can't parent well either, right?
Well, for the next 20 minutes, I want you to talk a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
Don't
I'm laughing. My students are kind of going, no, don't say that.
this show obviously is all about food, and I really believe that most people's food issues have to deal with emotional problems. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are so not obvious. You spend a chapter on it, but actually some of the other chapters, addictions and denial, I connect with people's food issues as well.
Yeah. Food is there for all of us, so we can all project onto it. We could all work. It's a relationship we have, like many other relationships, and then we can do our dance with it. So in that way, it's not only always an easy mirror, but it's a good mirror in the sense that it shows things. And like you're saying, the things that are going on for people are very, very rarely known. Most people think they're eating, let's say, for certain reasons that are almost never the reason. Let me give you an example. I could talk to a person who says, I want to stop eating ice cream. And I said, okay, why do you think you eat ice cream? Well, it comforts me, they'll say. Mm-hmm. And then most people will stop there. And many people would say, oh, that's true. You may need more comfort. But if you examine it with that person, that's very rarely the case. And how do you do that? Then I would say to the person, what kind of ice cream you like? And I'm thinking of somebody who said to me, I like salt caramel ice cream, she said. I think that's a great flavor, the salt and the caramel and the sweet. So I said, great. And then I said to her a very basic, what I call love-based question. What is it like for you to put that salt caramel ice cream in your mouth? Not your guilt. What happens to you when you taste it? It's a very simple question, but never asked. And she said, what do you mean? I shouldn't be eating it, right? It's bad. I said, I know. What happens to you? Imagine putting it in your mouth. And she goes, I said, that's it. What's it like? She said, it's like a singing in my heart. This woman said to me. I said, tell me, can you hear the singing? And why I'm asking that question is I want to know what her experience is. I think her experience is going to be meaningful and telltale. And she says, yeah, I can hear it. It's like these nuns who I hear singing in the church, but you can't see them. They're in the background. It's like the angels singing. Now, this woman had a very important and deep spiritual life. She identified as being a Christian woman, a good parent and spouse, great. But somehow she was still looking for something. She was looking for the angels singing. And in that taste, she got a little taste of that also, a little taste of the angel singing. So her remedy, as it were, for eating less ice cream was to listen to the angels more. That means to take more time to pray, to listen to certain kinds of music that connected her with her Christian faith, with Jesus for her, and things like that. People's hungers are never meaningless. I've never seen them be, well, I'm just stupid. They don't need
something. Well, I love that, and I love that. You started in the beginning of your book talking about how these symptoms that people have are really like a map to guide us to what it is we want and we need if we only would look at them in the right way.
Beautifully said. I want to write that down, by the way.
Symptoms are a map. You know, I realized when I said it, I said, he didn't say it this way, but that's
I know it.
How
sometimes people say things and I think, why didn't I think of saying it that way? I'm thinking of a woman, that's a story I've told before because it's so funny, who was she was a pot smoker and she wanted to stop smoking pot. We could say she was addicted to pot, some people would say that, whatever. But she was doing it and it wasn't only good for her and she wanted to stop. And I said, why do you do it? And she said, it makes me feel good. Well, most of us would say, well, that makes sense, right? She's doing it, she smokes pot, it makes her feel good. That's what she's looking for. She's looking to feel good. And then I said to her again, the basic, what I call loving question, can you tell me what it's like when you put that marijuana to your mouth and inhale it? What happens to you? And she says to me, I don't feel anything, she says. And I said, that's interesting. You don't feel anything? She says, no, but my husband, he gets really stoned, she tells me. So I say, well, that's interesting. How can you tell he's really stoned? I get this one. She says, he looks smaller to me. So of course I had to make a joke. Oh, you know that's a lot of drugs to have another person shrink. But she didn't get my joke. But
right.
But she was a woman who felt very small in her relationship. She was older, socialized to be a listener, to be a good quote unquote wife. So she had shrunken her powers, her intelligence, her personality to fit in. So the reason she feels so good when she smokes marijuana is not because it makes her feel good by itself. It makes her feel bigger. It makes her feel like her own size. And feeling her own size makes her more confident around her husband. They have a much better time together than when she's shrinking, trying to listen to him being a good self. Right? Now, she would never have known that. She just,
right.
No one ever asked the question. So her program, her addiction program, is to start practicing being more whole, more full, the bigger, her bigness, as it were. Then the marijuana won't have such a grip because it's doing that job for her.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, and I think I'm going to use this question, what is it like when you do such and such?
Yes.
With some of my activism work. Now, as you may know, I'm a vegan and I promote a plant-based diet. And my motive has been for a long time, since I was a teenager, not to create pain and suffering, exploitation, killing sentient beings. And then it expanded into other things when I realized that plant foods are healthier than animal foods and they're gentler on the environment. And I like to share this information that I've discovered with anybody who wants to hear it. But it's always been, I don't understand why people want to eat animals or feel comfortable eating animals, or why when they know factory farming is going on, why they would continue to support it. And some people don't care, some people do, but there's this denial factor, which I likened a lot to your later chapters when you talked about abuse and domestic violence. And not wanting to recognize the pain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's such a huge thing. Actually, I didn't expect you to go there. I got a little, my little heart got some tears in it. My wife Lisa is also very sensitive to the hurt of animals. Anyway, so your theme and topic touched me, and I first want to say thank you. Thanks for standing there against against opposition at times, and taking those hits. And anyway, thank you for that.
You're welcome. You know, when you were mentioning going through your own discovery with domestic violence and seeing and wanting to look away of the pictures of a woman that was abused and then causing yourself to look at the picture. I think that was an interesting discovery, and I want to, maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, because I need to work with that information with my own work.
It's a huge thing. If you Googled domestic violence, and you got, of course, you would get, you know, thousands and thousands of search results. But many of them, many articles, books, videos, would have the word silence in it. And they're using the word silence in that we are, as a culture, still relatively silent about what's happening. Not just the perpetrator and the victim, as it were, but the culture itself, relatively silent, relatively blind. We're not noticing it. I could hear somebody screaming in the other house, but I say that's not my business, right? Or I can look at somebody that I may know, or a friend, or potentially even a client, and they might say, I'm fine. And I can see by their gritted teeth or something in them, it's not quite true. People do that with their children. I had a client who was anorexic. She was a size zero. Her boyfriend criticized her for having a butt too big. Right? So she would go to the gym, and this is awful. She would go to the gym and exercise, but she had no food in her. She would have, like, broth and non-fat frozen yogurt. So she would go to the gym, and she'd pass out and end up having ET people coming and taken to her emergency room because there was no calories in her to burn. She'd come home, even after all that, and her parents would think, I don't understand what's wrong. You look so beautiful. And it's like, hello, right? This is the mismatch, right? And in that way, we're not seeing violence. This woman she's in a violent cycle. What to do about it is a complicated question. But there's a violence going on internally, probably in the family, as we were talking about. But it's not seen. So anyways, the Dr. Phil show you're referring to, he had a man and a woman, and she had bruises on her chest that you could see were like handprints, and colored bruises on her arms, I think it was. And I remembered after the show not really wanting to look at the pictures, and I remember her saying, it's not that bad, really, we're doing better. And then I think he says something like, on the outside, people would think we're just doing well. So I started thinking, how come people don't look? So I sort of made myself look at those images, and then I noticed all those feelings come up, like the way they do when most of us look at somebody who's been wounded or has blood. We get queasy, right? We want to look away. It's not only easy unless you're used to it, looking at hurt. So anyway, so that chapter sort of is a chapter of my own inner work, looking at what does it take for me to be available to another person's hurt, to not need to, quote, make it better, you know, heal it, fine, but make it better so that I feel more comfortable, or have them smile so that I feel more comfortable. It's a very deep dynamic within violent scenes also. So those people who are in violent relationships emotionally or physically, it's hard to even look at oneself and say, that's a bruise. I'm going to sleep at night criticizing myself. I got injured, right? We think, oh, you have low self-esteem. Maybe, but maybe that person got injured. Probably somewhere along the line.
Mm-hmm. You think this pulls for myself, because I know people don't want to look at what's going on in factory farming. It's very painful.
Yes.
And we need to see it. And often we take in that pain when we consume these foods. Yeah. Okay.
There's a culture, and this is not the whole culture, but there's a part of our culture says, don't worry, be happy, which is good at times, good message. But at times says, as you're kind of implying, don't really look. Please put a smile on your face, right? Please say, I'm feeling bright today. Please say, I'm prosperous. Please say, I'm in the light. Please say, blessings to you. Please say something positive. All of which has a good intention most of the time, but there's a shadow that is quite dark. I think Jung said the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. There's a shadow that's quite dark where there's a lot of very powerful things happening to the planet, to the earth, to animals, to ourselves inside. And that takes a little bit of heart and depth and openness to your own pain to not try to fix somebody enough to be open to theirs than they might want to share with you.
I think I really enjoyed reading this book and reading your example. I was uncomfortable reading about Dr. Phil and the way he managed these cases that you talked about. And I also wonder about the people who want to be on his show.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a whole other phenomenon.
Yes.
But I think we can all really benefit from understanding what you've put out here in terms of how we evaluate things. You started on the beginning talking about us all being so judgmental, and I didn't even realize it, but I was smiling saying, oh yeah, we do this all the time, where we've taken little pieces of modern mainstream psychology and incorporated them into our own selves where we think that we can judge things around us, and most of our judgment doesn't understand the deeper significance of what's going on.
Right. A lot of us, in a sense, we all practice psychology whenever we self-reflect. Why am I doing this? I'm a procrastinator, right? I'm not disciplined enough. I'm too quiet. I'm not quiet enough. I talk too much. These kinds of self-criticisms or other criticisms pass as psychology, meaning we sort of start to diagnose ourselves and try to change, right?
Yeah.
I know why I'm not losing weight. I'm sitting on the couch too much, somebody once said to me. This is a woman who tried to lose weight and gain weight and lose weight and gain weight, which is the most common result of weight loss strategies, for 30 years. She says, now I got it, right? I figured myself out. I've analyzed myself. And then I sort of asked her the basic questions. Tell me what it's like to be your size, to have a big round belly, or to eat the foods that you do, or to sit on the couch. You think it's a terrible thing to sit on the couch? She says, well, don't you? I said, not yet, I don't. I don't know what you're doing there. Tell me what it's like sitting on the couch. And then she says, well, I like to watch National Geographic shows. Oh, interesting. Tell me about that. I love looking into other countries and imagine being somewhere else. Tell me more about being somewhere else. Oh, I was in the Peace Corps for 6 months, and then I traveled once for 3 months to Asia. Oh, my gosh, she says. I said, wow. She goes, I lost so much weight when I did that. without a diet program, without making herself run each morning. Not that running each morning is a bad idea, but as soon as we took her out of mainstream culture for her, she instantly lost weight by herself. She's living in a culture inside of her and in her job and in her relationships that doesn't fit for her. So she goes off somewhere else. She sits on the couch. So if I don't know that, I say, get off the couch. But now that I know that, I know she needs to, quote unquote, sit on that couch more, meaning live more of a National Geographic life, live less of an American culture life. That's the help that she needs. Running for 15 minutes a day might help, but it might be too good of an American woman, right? You know, doing her jogging.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with jogging. Amen. But her psyche says that's not what she's looking for. She's looking for something else.
So do you, so the next question is, people can ask themselves, if they can't go and see you in New Mexico, obviously, and they want to find a way to lose weight or eat a better diet or improve some sort of emotional problem, they ask themselves these questions, and then does it normally find the solution? How does that work?
Okay. Well, I have to do a little bit of self-promotion statement because I've been shy to tell people, but I do phone work and Skype work all over the country and usually can figure out making time for people. But anyway, that's my shyness. Please forgive me.
Good for you. Let me say, you need to do that.
The first thing I think it's useful to do is if people can voice, even out loud, in front of somebody else or themselves, the criticisms they have, either for their eating or their bodies, say them out loud, because inside they're like insulated from critical thinking, from diagnosing. Many people, if they hear the voices in their head out loud, are aghast at how brutal they are to themselves. I think 97% of women are considered cruel to themselves around their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, you know, so, and men also, although it's talked about less, and there's less social pressure. So it's easier for men. So the first thing I think is to notice, just become aware of how rough that environment is. If you heard a friend, or somebody you love talk to themselves that way, or somebody talk to that way, you probably wouldn't just stand there and say, oh yeah, sure, you are a piece of whatever, you know. You would say, oh my gosh, you know, that I can't stand
mm-hmm.
that. So that's that reflection. But then the second question, what is it like? That does take some care. Don't try to answer that question in 2 minutes. Make a therapy session for yourself, at least 15 minutes, it's not an hour, right, to answer that question. It's really worth reflecting on. What's it like? And then if people can do that, imagine, if it's a food thing, imagine tasting that food. And then if I was talking to a large group of people, I'd say, imagine a song that goes through your head that is similar to that feeling. I imagine Blue Sky or something. I like the Allman Brothers,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I'd say to them, if you could, if you're free enough, make a little dance to that music. So now,
David, this is great, but we're out of time. So,
oh my gosh, we can't be out of time.
It went really quickly, and you talked a lot.
Oh, good. I think
it was all good. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking back to Dr. Phil. And where can people find you?
Great, thanks a lot. They can find me on talkingbacktodrphil.com. That's talkingbacktodr. Phil.com, and they can. The book is 18 chapters. It's got all kinds of stories and approaches to large range of topics, and they can see their Psych Today articles and articles in many different magazines and some videos. If they want to just get some good free advice, they can go there as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Send me an email, info@realmeals.org. Visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, and have a delicious week.